This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Good morning, folks. Can everybody hear me? It's been 34 years, June 1973, since John Dean testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He was a young, 34-year-old president's counsel at the time. As we all recall, he testified that President Nixon was involved in criminal activities relating to the Watergate scandal. In his testimony before the Senate committee, Dean claimed that Nixon knew about the break-in at the Democratic headquarters and that he also took part in the cover-up. Dean supporters saw him as a courageous and truthful individual. His detractors considered him a self-serving and disloyal individual. Subsequent disclosures and the famous White House tapes corroborated Dean's testimony, and of course, Nixon ultimately resigned. John would wind up in a witness protection program at Fort Holloway, Maryland, in beautiful downtown Baltimore. John Dean was born in Akron, Ohio, in 1938. He graduated from Wooster College in Ohio and Georgetown Law School. His first job in the government was as the chief minority counsel with the House Judiciary Committee. He then served as an associate deputy to the Attorney General's office before going to the White House as a presidential counsel. Since Watergate, he has worked as an investment banker in California and written columns, essays, and books on a wide variety of subjects, including biographies on President Warren Harding and Chief Justice William Rehnquist. His best-selling books include Blind Ambition, Worse Than Watergate, and Conservatives Without a Conscience. Here this morning, he will speak on his current best-selling book, Broken Government. And I have a copy here, and I'm looking forward to all of you getting a copy of this. And his present book, The Broken Government, of course, tells us how the Republican rule has destroyed the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. It is my pleasure to introduce John Dean, and welcome to our OSHA organization here at UCSD. John?
I was asking Dan if he got some of that information from Google. I follow Google closely because it's supposed to be self-correcting. It is not always quite correct. I'll just since we're making a record, and I have a small microphone on me and one here, I'm not used to seeing small microphones when I'm talking. Those of you who know what I'm talking about are clearly over 45 years of age. But anyway, a couple quick points. I didn't testify that Nixon knew about the Watergate break-in because I don't believe anybody in the Nixon White House knew that they were going to do that foolish, rather remarkable and stupid activity and breaking into the Watergate in June of 72. There's no question, however, that afterwards he did know about the cover-up, as the tapes clearly show. But to this date, I've never seen any evidence he did know. The rest of the Google also the other, just to clean up one other minor point, I was the associate deputy attorney general, who actually is a officer in the department, not just necessarily in the attorney general's office. Details. Last time I was here, actually I was here last night. I did countdown from San Diego last night with Keith Oberman, and then gave a chat over at the Escondido Library, where about 300 plus people showed up, and we had a nice evening together. And I appreciated that they tore themselves away from about what, maybe the 101st debate and some 200 debates that are ongoing. And reading the reports this morning, apparently it was a fairly interesting debate. When I was here last, though, it was when the fires occurred, and I certainly hope nobody here was affected. I do feel and did feel some relief when George Bush showed up. The relief I felt was he didn't dress up as a fireman and announce that nor did he curse us with a mission accomplished announcement. The new book is really part of an unplanned trilogy. I promised myself when I was active in business in the aftermath of Watergate that when I turned 60, I would return to writing. I'd done a couple books and enjoyed them. I had once been an editor of a school paper. I had been an English lit major. I'd done a lot of writing in school. As lawyers, we all do a lot of writing in that business. And so I promised myself that when I turned 60, which I did some 9 years ago, that I would return to writing, and have done so. I started doing it first for an online publication called FindLaw. It's a publication that is now owned by one of the largest legal publishing firms in the country. And there are 10 columnists who every other week we crank out columns, and I've been doing this for 7 years now. When I first started, I really wasn't terribly political, but when the Bush administration came in, I noticed that a lot of things that were quite conspicuous to me were not being addressed by the mainstream media or anybody, particularly the conspicuous secrecy of the Bush administration. So I did a few columns on that, and when you're writing online, you can actually tell how many eyeballs at least open your page, and rather, you don't know if they read it, but they certainly open it. And I noticed the more I got into these subjects, the higher the rate of hits were occurring on these columns, getting some really rather hefty numbers, getting into six figures on some columns. And just every time I was talking about how things were really working in Washington versus the fact that there was no one talking about them, that seemed to draw a lot of attention. Now, those columns tend to be about 1,500, 2,000 words, which is a good bit of distance where you can lay out a lot of information, but still, it wasn't doing the job. So that's when I decided to write the first in this trilogy, Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. I still have a lot of friends, a lot of contacts in Washington. While I've lived in Southern California for 30-some years, in fact, I think Dan, maybe the simple introduction is really he's the guy who's still married to Maureen Dean, because many people remember her even better than me. Indeed, I have three grandchildren. In fact, dedicate the last book to my three grandchildren. But anyway, the FindLaw columns were covering a lot of ground. When I decided to do the book, I knew I could cover more ground, and relying on, I don't like unidentified sources, unlike my friend Bob Woodward, who doesn't document or tell you where he gets anything. I'm just the opposite. I like to explain where I'm getting everything. But I was talking to people who have, they're both highly elected, they're high elected officials, and some of them are high appointed officials, and indeed, they didn't really necessarily want to talk as candidly as I wanted to talk, but they were very helpful in telling me where to look. And very quickly, they had me looking at what was happening in the vice president's office, which struck those inside, starting right with the transition between 2000 and 2001, before they set up shop, and actually before the inauguration, that Cheney had, notwithstanding the fact he was feeling very bad and had some serious health problems, it was clear he was going to take charge right from the start. And truly, I think that after watching him now for, almost 7 years, that his genius has been to take that knowledge he had as White House Chief of Staff and then as a member of Congress in the leadership and somebody who also served as a cabinet officer, to take all that knowledge. And literally, he has used it to swallow the presidency. He has done so in, as I say, with some genius, because people who become president do not have small egos. It is not possible to become president if you have a small ego, given the route you must travel. But what Cheney has done, his genius is, he lets George Bush actually wake up every morning and believe he is president. And he does this by the way he controls the flow of paper and the way he guides the operations of the White House and the executive branch. Cheney knows that, you know, it's if you limit the decisions that the president is making, you're actually controlling the decision. So the decider is deciding, but he's deciding what Cheney wants him to decide. Not in every area, but I'm talking about the most important areas. Every time I looked behind the shroud that covers this White House, there was Dick Cheney. He's not a man I know. He worked at the Nixon White House. I don't recall ever meeting him. He worked for Don Rumsfeld, who I did know. I'd known Rumsfeld on Capitol Hill. Cheney was up there when I was up there, too, and I don't recall ever meeting him. I have no bias or feeling against him one way or the other. In fact, notwithstanding the less than subtle titles of my books, I really don't have any partisan bias, or nor do I mean to be pejorative in talking about these people. But rather, I long ago decided I would register, or we don't in California, you know, we either don't affiliate with either of the party, which makes us in essence independents, and when pollsters call, I say I am an independent because I have not registered my affiliation with either party for a long time now. And I don't carry partisan water for anybody. I am interested only in one thing, and that is how can we make this government work in its best way? And if the Democrats can do it or if the Republicans do it, I'm going to be the first to applaud, and I'm also going to be the first taking my inside knowledge and tell you what I at least see has gone astray. And that's what these books do. It's a genre I wish in many ways I could write myself out of, that things would get back on kilter and I wouldn't be writing these books. I had planned to write biographies and histories and not active political commentary. But with nobody talking about it and knowing what I do know, it was just something I felt I had to share. So that has been the genesis of the book. And when I finished Worse Than Watergate, I realized maybe I shouldn't have used that title even. There is a somewhat of a pejorative overtone in the title, because actually a better title probably would have been Much Worse Than Watergate. If you look at Watergate and the so-called litany of activities that constituted Nixon's abuses of power, those that were investigated by both House and Senate and the Watergate Special Prosecutor, nobody died as a result of Watergate. Nobody was tortured as a result of any of those activities. Millions of Americans didn't have their conversations, electronic conversations, subject to warrantless wiretaps. So we're playing in a very different league today, a very different league, way beyond anything Richard Nixon ever conceived of. He was being aggressive when he wiretapped seven some newsmen because they were bylining columns that were coming directly out of his National Security Council. Today, this would look like a minor offense, although it was included in the draft bill of impeachment that was existing before he resigned. And he did it, as he thought, for very good national security reasons, because the fact that somebody on the National Security Council was leaking his decisions or his options, it was precluding what he could decide and would decide because it was popping up in the New York Times or wherever, and he wanted to find out and stop it. That was the whole goal of his surveillance. So when you get in these areas of national security, they're all very gray. And I, in writing all three of these books, have not really tried to cast any of these people as evil, because I don't believe that to be the case. To the contrary, I think they're well-intentioned. But it's very odd when you're inside the Beltway and how it must be in the water. It must be in the water, because they're thinking changes, and somehow I actually think you can see the government much better when you get outside the Beltway than you can when you're inside. But anyway, the Worse Than Watergate book actually prompted the book that is my last book, the Broken Government book, because what happened when I wrote Worse Than Watergate, I had no idea, I had nothing in mind about the 2004 election. But as the election proceeded, I thought it was inevitable that whoever the Democratic candidate was going to be, that they were going to look at this issue of the excessive secrecy of this presidency and what was going on, and many of the issues I'd raised in Worse Than Watergate. So I was quite surprised, and I found I wasn't alone in being surprised, that John Kerry didn't raise any of these issues in 2004. In fact, about 10 days, 2 weeks before the election, the New York Times, in an editorial, in essence said, you know, Mr. Kerry, haven't you noticed down in Washington we may have the most secret presidency we've ever had? And don't you think this is an issue that maybe should be shared with voters when they go to the polls in November? After he lost, I decided to call the Kerry campaign to find out why they had ignored this secrecy. And I didn't call the candidate because it was clearly a campaign-wide decision. So I wanted to find out the senior thinking in the campaign and did just that and was told, yes, we certainly saw the secrecy of the Bush administration and we were certainly troubled about it. But the reason we didn't raise it in the campaign is because we thought it was a process issue. And our consultants and advisors told us that most Americans don't care about process issues. Well, this struck me as rather odd. So I began then calling some of the candidates who had run against incumbent Republicans, Democrats, to see how they had handled issues at the congressional level, where I was quite aware that Republicans, and congressional Republicans, were also abusing process. And I asked them questions like, these are people who had just come close to winning but not quite had won, selected races I had followed. And I asked them, you know, I looked at your literature. I don't see anything in your literature where you raised, for example, the fact that the Congress is only working 2 days a week under the Republicans. I didn't see anything in your literature about the fact that many, many very important pieces of legislation are being written on K Street by the lobbyists and set up and inserted in bills in the dead of the night, and sometimes not even the Republicans have a clue what is in that legislation. And I said, I didn't notice you really explaining in any of your literature, and maybe you can correct me, maybe you did it in your campaign speeches, that in essence the Republicans have remove the Democrats from the deliberative process in the Congress, that you have nothing to say, that in fact over half of the country that is represented by Democrats in Washington, more than represented by Republicans, has no voice anymore the way they run the place. And I said, don't you think these issues were pretty important? And when I began telling me that no, they hadn't raised them in speeches either, and I said, well, tell me why you didn't raise them. Well, I never got anybody to say directly that the Democratic campaign committees or the Democratic leadership had said, don't do this, but it was pretty implicit in the remarks that they, because it kept repeating itself, I was told by these Democrats, that they believed it had been suggested to them that to raise these issues would make them appear wimpy and complaining and whiny. And they didn't want to do that. Actually, a couple others did raise the issues after making very, I found, as I quote in Broken Government, a couple of the now leaders who had tough races and thought this was important did raise this, but always did it with a preface, I want you to know I'm not complaining or I'm not whining or I'm not trying to be too obtuse on these things, but the process is not working. But it was rare. When I looked at the 2004 Democratic platform, I was stunned to find that not only had Kerry's campaign not raised process issues, for the first time in tracking Democratic and Republican platforms back to, I went back as far as 1960 and looked at them, the Democrats did not raise a single process issue in their platform. Not that platforms are that important, but they do show and reflect sort of the internal thinking of the rank and file of the party. But they had been excluded from the 2004. Well, this sent me looking, because I happen to like empirical evidence and not just pundits' advice, because a lot of this attitude towards process is exactly what the pundits are saying in Washington. They're saying people don't care about it. And I just wanted to find out if they're right or wrong. Well, let me tell you this morning, they are dead wrong. Academics, in fact, I found a team, some of the strongest information I found came from a team over at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, that reported they indeed, not looking for this particular issue, but rather in a broader study, had discovered a very significant number of voters. The first thing they think about, the first thing they're interested in, is how the machinery of government is functioning under either Republicans or Democrats. How are the processes working? How decisions are being made? Because they intuitively seem to understand that if you have a good process, you get good policy. If you have a bad process, you're going to get bad policy. Most people can't tell you, for example, what a motion to recommit is in the House of Representatives, a process right now being used very effectively by Republicans to beat up and defeat and cause problems in the House as the Democrats are in control to try to process legislation. Nor can most people tell you really much about the way a cloture vote works in the Senate and why members of the Senate, when they threaten to filibuster, aren't actually forced on the floor to stand up and filibuster. But rather, all they have to do is say, we will filibuster, and then it takes 60 votes to cut that filibuster off. But people do get one thing. They understand whether they've had any civics in their education at all, or even if they're not particularly active in following political events. They just pick up enough from our culture, from daily life in America, that they know that the government isn't designed to work for Republicans only. It isn't designed to work for Democrats only. It's designed to work for everybody, for you people, for everybody else. And they do know when they're getting screwed. And they realize that this certainly popped up in 2006, where people realized the Republicans were screwing them. And this is one of the reasons. It wasn't just, yes, a lot of people were unhappy about the war, no question. But you read and sift through some of the polls I look at, and you realize that the unhappiness with the way the government and direction of the government is going, this isn't a highly sophisticated analysis of policy. This is typically a very much a process issue, and it's never been higher, and it cuts across all party lines when people are dissatisfied with the government. And it's because they understand it isn't working in their best interest, for sure. And typically, again, as I say, it's process. Anyway, I wrote this book not for Democrats, not for Republicans, this last book, but rather for everybody to understand the processes are broken. And let me just put in the middle, because we're going to open this up for questions very shortly, the other book, because it all fits in. The Conservatives Without Conscience book was written, actually it's a book I had started many years earlier, back in 1991-92. Shortly after Clinton had been elected. I'm a longtime fan, friend, and admirer of the late Senator Barry Goldwater. His son and I went to school together, prep school, and have been friends, close friends, ever since. We're more like brothers than friends, and we've had an ongoing conversation and relationship for 50-some years now, so we know each other pretty well. And when his dad left the Senate, Barry had served in Congress, and actually we lived across the street from each other back in Washington, small world department. As it happens, He had had a couple of blind dates with the lady I married, Maureen Dean, and he said, well, we didn't get along, but she's sure pretty, and you might give her a ring. Here's the number. So I owe him a great debt of gratitude, because I found out over the years there's two ways you can learn about people. One is get in business with them, and you'll certainly learn about them. The other is to marry them, and you learn about them. And I've been fortunate to have good partners in all those things. But anyway, Barry called and said, listen, Dad's bored. Maybe you and he could gin up some kind of project. He loves talking to you, visiting with you. Why don't you think about that? So I called him. And to make that long story short, which I actually put in the preface of Conservatives Without Conscience, in the course of our conversations, he said, you know what really bothers me, John, and what I have on my mind and cannot get off my mind is what's happened to conservatism. I feel great responsibility for the conservative movement, having in 64 really initiated it, and first watching these people who are now in the religious right, who gave me fits when I was still in the Senate. It was well known his position on the religious right when it came really surfaced when Sandra Day O'Connor was nominated to become a Supreme Court justice and Jerry Falwell opposed her. I paused there because I, for the first time, met Sandra Day O'Connor on Monday of this week. I was at the Franklin Roosevelt Library for a conference on presidents and the Supreme Court, and she was the keynoter. Lovely lady. We had a delightful conversation because of our mutual admiration for the late senator. But anyway, when Falwell opposed Nixon, opposed the appointment of Sandra Day, he and Falwell announced that any good Christian would vote against Sandra Day going on the court. Goldwater's famous comment, of course, was that any good Christian should be kicking Jerry Falwell in the ass for his opinion on Sandra Day. Senator did not mince words when he had his thoughts. But he had said, he told me when I called him, he said, you know, I've been going back to Washington, and what has driven me back there, and I'm doing shows like Larry King, and I'm doing Meet the Press and shows like that, because I cannot understand the incivility that has now entered into the Republican ranks and the conservative movement. He said, it distresses me greatly. They're going to drive good people out of office or seeking office. He said, I'm offended at how they're attacking Bill Clinton, who's just getting his feet on the ground, and I'm horrified and offended by the way they're treating Hillary Clinton. And I have let them know exactly. I've done it privately in sessions with the leaders, and I'm doing it publicly because they don't seem to hear. And he said, it's not making me terribly popular with my former colleagues. He said, I also have had some problem over out here in Arizona recently. He said, because the religious right was able to capture and the party here and take and nominate one of their own for the 6th Congressional District of Arizona, a guy I knew, and a guy who was claiming that he was a Goldwater conservative, I solved that problem by endorsing the Democrat and woman that was running against him, who I think would be a terrific member of Congress. She's 10 times smarter than he is. She is not a nut like he is. And she would be a very good representative of Arizona. She's lived in the state much longer than he has. And when I did that, John, he said, the powers that be here in Arizona came to me and said, Senator, you know, we're watching what you're doing in Washington. We're watching what you're doing here in Arizona. And you've got to remember, we built that building in downtown Phoenix, that new headquarters, and we call it the Barry M. Goldwater Republican headquarters for the Republican Party of Arizona. And he said, this particular official said to the senator, said, you know, Senator, if you keep doing what you're doing, we're going to have to take your name off that building. Well, that didn't sit too well with the senator. And so he responded rather quickly. He said, let me tell you, and you tell everybody in the Arizona Party, and any conservative you meet, if you all keep doing what you're doing, I hope you will take my name off that building as soon as you can get it off. The name is still on the building. Anyway, he was deeply concerned about this. He said, John, let's find out what's going on. He said, I've got a lot of papers in my files that are traced through everything from correspondence to talks I gave to meetings I had that trace the conservative movement to its present form. But let's take it the next step and find out why these people are thinking and acting the way they are. So we started on the project. Unfortunately, his health did not hold up. I realized at one point this is going to become a burden on him. So I said to the senator, I said, listen, let's put this on the shelf until you're feeling better. Unfortunately, he never did feel better. And after he passed away, I kept thinking about it, kept gathering material, kept thinking about the subject, because I just couldn't let it go. And after I did worse than Watergate, I realized that this, I haven't really ever addressed the question the senator's raising, is why are conservatives doing what they're doing? Because to this day, I still consider myself a Goldwater conservative on many issues. That, of course, today places me, as it does the senator, well left of center. The senator once said during the 64 campaign that history would likely look back on him as a liberal. And I think he was prescient. I think that's exactly what's going to happen. The right has gone so far and so hard to the right that it indeed makes him look highly moderate to liberal on countless issues. I mean, his position on gays in the military, which he didn't shy away from when Clinton was trying to resolve that problem. He didn't care. He said, I don't care about their sexual orientation. He said the question is not whether they're straight or not, it's whether they can shoot straight. And he said, that's the criteria we want for soldiers. I read some fascinating obituaries after he died where people said that he had changed his position on abortion after he had remarried when his longtime wife had died, and he remarried in his later years, and he married a woman who was very active in feminist politics, and that she had obviously turned his head around on an issue like abortion. Absolutely untrue. I'd found in his correspondence, even before Roe v. Wade, the senator was saying women should have their own choice, and no man should ever tell a woman what she could do with her body. So this wasn't a new issue for him, but rather a long time. It's part of his philosophy is sort of comes out of the classic liberalism and libertarianism that grew and with his own development as a sort of a Western business entrepreneur before he became involved in politics. But anyway, I wish he were around for when I did find the answers that he and I had talked about. The title of the book, Conservatives Without Conscience, came from one of our conversations where he literally said to me, he said, John, I think conservatives have lost their conscience. Clearly a play on his classic book, The Conscience of a Conservative. It's a big issue, how conservatives think, and he said they just don't think anymore is the biggest problem. A few of them just have their opinions, and you either believe them and buy them or you don't. And he said, I don't think this is the way it should work. And these were some of the keys that started me doing research where I ended up finding a body of science I didn't even know existed. In the aftermath of World War II, up in Berkeley, a group of social scientists looked at the question, could what happened in Nazi Germany ever happen in the United States? Would Americans, any part of America, ever be like the good German and tolerate, say, a Holocaust or a Hitler? Would they sit back and let that happen? After many years of study, this group in the early 50s published a book called The Authoritarian Personality. The book laid out based on Freudian psychology that indeed there was evidence that there were people who would very easily follow an authoritarian leader. The book has never been proven wrong, as Freudian psychology has never been proven wrong, but it hasn't been proven right either. So other social scientists began looking at the issue, is there hard empirical evidence that there are people like this? And we now have a half century, literally, of data, hard empirical evidence, where tens upon tens of thousands of people have been questioned anonymously and tested for their authoritarian disposition. And it's very telling that clearly there is an authoritarian personality. What's very interesting is not all conservatives are authoritarians, but all highly scoring authoritarians tend to be highly conservative. They are people who submit very quickly to the authoritarian leader whose beliefs have attracted their attention. They don't want to hear any counter-arguments once they buy into it. They don't want to think a lot about it, but they want to understand that leader's worldview and then become very aggressive in trying to sell it to others. They tend to be very religious people. They're people who are both men and women. They also, sadly, are bullies. People who are in the out-group, they can tend to be very abusive about. They pick on weaker people. Homosexuals is a very typical group they will go after because they don't think they fit into their worldview. And they exist. And as I say, we now have the first 40 years of this work focused on these people who they call right-wing authoritarians. They're actually a more descriptive title is right-wing authoritarian followers. In the last decade plus, social scientists have also looked at who are the authoritarian leaders. They are social dominators is what they are people who, they are 99% men. They are people who will jump out in front and say, follow me, I've got all the answers and let's go. They are people who are typically amoral. They may or may not be religious. They are highly Machiavellian. They will take a leader in front of them and pretend to be submissive to that leader so long as they can get in and learn how to cut him off at the knees and get the leadership post themselves. They are bullies also. There is only one view, and it's the view they have settled on to use to dominate whatever organization or group they're trying to do so. Interestingly also, there's a third group, and these have only emerged in the last few years of testing, and they are the people who would become my conservatives without conscience. They are people who are social dominators who have also been given tests where they score high as right-wing followers. And this is an anomaly. Well, how can they be both leaders and followers? It just made no sense. So they began examining it, and what they found is that the people who have these double high scores are people who see themselves running the world. So when they answer the questions as to following an authoritarian leader, they're answering them as if they were the leader. And they want people to be submissive. They want them to be bullies. They want them to be aggressive. And so you have this rather unique category. A prototypical real-world example would be somebody like a Hitler is a classic double high. Just to complete this science, because it was so fascinating and it began answering so many questions, they don't find that there are people who are left-wing authoritarians, which explains a lot about Republicans versus Democrats, if you will. And again, I say this, this isn't pejorative, it's descriptive. And it's based, the labels and descriptions I'm giving aren't some tags that social scientists have put on these people, but rather it's the way they describe themselves. And when they try to test for the left, they're just not terribly authoritarian in being followers or even as social dominators. Leadership doesn't mean social domination by any stretch of the imagination. When I first began thinking about this, it was clear since the when I looked at the conservative movement and how it had evolved based on material that I found in the senator's files and my own knowledge of the movement, I suddenly recognized an awful lot of authoritarian followers. In fact, I got a hold of the leading researcher in the field, and he was gracious enough to help me out because I had been reading all of his published works as well, his books, as well as a number of his professional journal articles with the Idiot's Guide to Statistics beside me, because I hadn't had a course in statistics, and this stuff was not written for the general reader. It's written for other academics, social, other professional peers. But I was so fascinated with it, and I got a hold of him, and I said to him, his name is Bob Altmer. I said, you know, Bob, I recognize now that I've sorted through all this material of yours, these are the people I was working with in the Nixon White House for the first thing. And I can tell you, you know, I knew these people well. And I know other people in the conservative movement very well. And I understand their personality. Is it legitimate to indeed take these traits that you have found in testing and say, if I see that in a consistent pattern in people, that indeed you can say that person fits that description and is an authoritarian personality? He said, yes. He said, it's not like quite like doing psychoanalysis from reading a biography, and it's not psychobabble. It is that there is clearly these traits, if they dominate a personality you know, indeed there's nothing illegitimate and improper in identifying that person as being an authoritarian. It's in fact, I would do it if I had that kind of knowledge. I don't have that kind of knowledge, notwithstanding the fact I'm an American. He is actually up in Canada. He was a Yale-trained, then Carnegie Mellon PhD, who went up there because of his freedom to do a lot of research. And he has probably the leading data bank, and his work has been corroborated and replicated by literally hundreds of other social scientists. So I was very fortunate. In fact, just for your further information, if you get interested in this subject, I kept prodding him to say to him, Bob, you know, just in my emails I could tell that he's very witty, he writes well, and I said, you need to take this information that you've written for all your professional peers and do something for the general reader. And indeed, he's done that, and he's put it online free. It's on, just Google the authoritarians and the name Altmeyer, Altmeyer. And I've had some complaints in giving this name out and this Google suggestion out, because got a mail from more than one person said, you kept me up all night looking at this material. Because he summarizes, while I do so also, I think he does it in a very good way and even more broadly than I do. This explained so much to me about current and contemporary Republican politics. It answered questions. It made me understand why they act the way they do, what's happened to the incivility, and it was the light bulb just went off. I just wish the senator had been around to see that data, because I think it would have explained a lot to him as well. I took that data, I took that information, and that's what I project into broken government. In broken government, I didn't try to prepare a complete list of everything that Republican rule has done to each of the branches. That wasn't my interest. You could do that to either party. What more interested to me, and because I'm not interested in policy as much as I am in process, was to show how the Republicans have, with the Democrats ignoring it and not calling them, they have gamed the system. They have twisted the processes. They have done so in such a way that they have taken, and this was my criteria, that had to be this serious, they have taken a particular branch off of its constitutional foundations. With the Congress, when they were controlling it, while it's under repair today, they're still trying to do the same thing they did before through their obstructionism of anything the Democrats are trying to do. They want people to believe the Democrats can't run the place any better than they could, so they're tying up and trying to defeat through various obstruction tactics and processes and prohibiting the Democrats from getting any credit for doing anything. And that's what they'll be running on in 08. In other words, they have destroyed the deliberative process. This is pretty serious because this was the design of the founders, and when Republicans controlled that body, I also found they couldn't even spell the word oversight. They just didn't even get the concept that that was one of their institutional responsibilities, was to check on the other branches of government, particularly the executive branch. It was a non-existent factor. In fact, as I was saying on Countdown last night, in the question that Keith asked me, was it unusual that Harry Reid is now keeping enough members of the Senate in Washington during the Thanksgiving holidays that Bush can't make a recess appointment? And I said, it is absolutely, they're finally getting the point that they're not going to let the Republicans outgame them on playing the process. And this is a check that should have been done long ago. He's announced he's going to do it, and I said, as I said last night, I said he should not only do it for Thanksgiving, but he should do it for Christmas too, because Bush has a backlog of radical judges he wants to put on the court, and that's when a lot of them will go in. Bush has also pushed there's a difference between an acting appointment and a recess appointment. An acting appointee, which Bush has filled a number of posts with that exceed all prior presidents, by not even sending them to the Senate, but just putting them in as the acting director of an agency or department or sub-cabinet post, and totally defeating the system. We've got, I think it's somewhere up to around 120, 130 people now are acting heads of various departments and agencies. And the Democrats clearly, in a few instances, like U.S. attorneys, they've put limits on this, where you can have a U.S. attorney acting only for a very limited period. This has got to be the Democrats have to step up and deal with these process issues again, and not only not say anything, but actually take aggressive action and deal with them. In looking at the executive branch, I'm most struck how Cheney has come back with a constant theme that he had first as a chief of staff, later as a secretary of defense, and even when he was on Capitol Hill, and on the most dubious, if not fraudulent, arguments, claiming that the Constitution doesn't say what it really says, that the Congress decides matters of war and peace, when we commit our troops and when we bring them home, that the President, under the Commander-in-Chief Clause, has this decision to be made, relying on some of the most questionable scholarship I've ever seen. The leading proponent of this, and this is the basis they went and they've undertaken things, everything from declaring enemy combatants to torture, based on memos out of the Office of Legal Counsel and the Justice Department written by John Yoo. I decided to show people in a general reader format, and my general reader is Mo, because she will tell me if this stuff is dull or if it gets her attention. And this was the sort of section that she said, I didn't know this, and it got her attention when I showed how fraudulent this and intellectually dishonest conservative scholarship has become, and it's a travesty. And we're conducting actions that are outside the Constitution based on these bogus arguments, and I try to lay this out pretty clearly. But probably the most important chapter in the book is the chapter about the federal judiciary, is because it surprised me the most. Tracking back to Nixon and my presidency and watching what happened, and it's very clear, and it's very different for the Republican presidents versus Democratic presidents. Republican presidents have worked assiduously at politicizing the non-political branch, and they have taken it now to a tipping point. Conservative judges, per se, don't frighten me. Fundamentalist conservative judges, who are radical, the Scalias and the Thomases and while they're a little slicker and a little bit easier to think, well, these might be okay guys, John Roberts and Sam Alito, they're just two more fundamentalists. You're one seat short of having five fundamentalist judges on the court. And if that happens, it will change the law of this land in a way it could never happen through either of the political branches. It will consummate the politicalization of the non-political branch. And it'll take the law to where, as I read it, about 75% of the American people don't want it. Who are the 25%? That's that residual that Bob Altmaier tells me is going to always be present in the American population, who are authoritarian personalities. Now, they're the people, when you look at Nixon's ratings getting down to the 25%, you look at Bush's ratings, he's got that hard group, there's always that 25%, and that's who those people are. They want these fundamentalist conservatives to be running the country. If Bush has an opening before he leaves, I think that the Senate must do, and we can only pray that they will do, what they did when, say, Ted Olson's name came up as Attorney General. And my former Georgetown classmate, Pat Leahy, said, we won't confirm him. They've just got to say, we won't fill that vacancy until after the 2008 election. And if Rudy is elected, you can bet there'll be there may not be one, but there may be three more fundamentalist judges added, because John Paul Stevens is getting up in the 80s. He seems to be in good health, but anything can happen. Ruth Ginsburg is in her 70s. She's had some health problems. But more surprising, the youngest, one of the younger members, who is one of the centrists on the court, David Souter, it has come out that he was so disgusted with Bush v. Gore, he was ready to resign after that. If you put one more fundamentalist on that court, he's not going to stay there. So then you could theoretically get three more. And that is a serious disaster for this country. Anyway, this two issues must be present in 2008 that are not on the table yet. Process is important. Process matters. Process is vital. The mainstream media is not answering or addressing these questions or raising them. It came up, there is a new site out, the Guardian of the United Kingdom has put out a new American online edition called Guardian American. In the introductory material, they said, we're going to ask questions that we notice the American press doesn't ask. And indeed, in one of their first interviews, they interviewed Hillary Clinton on a pure process question. And they asked her, they said, Senator Clinton, how do you feel about the Bush-Cheney administration's gathering of executive powers? And she just banged that one right out of the park. She said, it's a power grab. It is excessive. It is troublesome. And the Michael Thomason, the editor of the Guardian American, you can find this just by Googling Guardian American. Thomason said, well, would any president conceivably relinquish any of his or her powers? And I thought Senator Clinton's answer was, again, right out of the park. She said, absolutely. You don't hear a lot of candidates saying that. This is something that should be in the debates that the Democrats are having now, and if not, it should certainly be. The primaries I don't pay a whole lot of attention to because they're such fine wires and lines that both sides have to walk through to get the nomination to lean one way and then tack the other way, that it's really not representative where they're likely to come out in the general election. It's going to be much more important that this issue come up, that process is vital in the general election, and that something's got to be done where the Democrats don't let the Republicans, because this isn't just Bush and Cheney, this is the Republican philosophy today. That's why I wrote this book, to explain. This isn't just Bush and Cheney, this goes deep. This is a change in conservatism that once distrusted aggregations of power. where today this is all they want. They want a super powerful president that dominates all the branches. Exactly what the founders tried to have us not have. So that issue and the Supreme Court have got to be front and center in 2008. And if they're not, we're in a lot of trouble. I thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.